The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to have some little nameplates put in front of us, so help identify people. But if I could quickly do some introductions. On my right, I have Yuval Ginbarth, legal advisor, Amnesty International. On his right, Jens Ferkel from the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. On his right is Yao Nataf, who's the secretary of the UN Committee Against Torture. On my left, Felice Geer, a member of the UN Committee Against Torture. On her left, Santiago Cantón, executive secretary of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And on his left is Florence Simbiri Jaco, who's the chairperson of the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. The subject of our panel is building on CAT's successes and addressing shortcomings and stakeholders' perspectives. In other words, the strengths, weaknesses of the CAT, setting essentially the scene for the debate for today's review of the work of the committee. I will be asking the speakers to not only stay focused on the subject matter, to provide very frank views on the work of the committee, but also to try to be succinct of 10 minutes approximately presentations, so that we can have a discussion afterwards with questions from the floor and responses from the panelists. So that's how we intend to get through the next hour and a half, and I would like to start the proceedings by inviting Yuval to open with his presentation. Thank you, Yuval. You have the floor.
Okay. good morning. With 10 minutes, I'll skip the bit where I thank Dean Grossman, the WCL, my college at Amnesty International, the other participants, and all of you for coming. I'll talk in sandwich format. There'll be mostly criticism, constructive, I hope, of some aspects of the work of the Committee Against Torture, flanked by both ends with thin layers of praise. As you know, just as the Arabs of old have 1,000 words for camels, human rights organizations have 1,000 words for expressing condemnation, dismay, concern, disappointment, etc. But when we come to praising, I think we use Amnesty International welcomes, immediately followed by, however, we remain concerned, etc. For me personally, the committee holds fond memories from my first encounter with it in the mid-1990s when I worked for a human rights organization in Israel, B'Tselem, and the committee reacted swiftly and decisively to Supreme Court rulings which facilitated torture. It called for a special report from Israel and came up with brave findings that Israel's ostensibly mild form of interrogation, such as hooding, sleep deprivation, and painful positions, hitherto addressed only by the European Court of Human Rights, and lamely at that, constituted not only cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, but also torture. To get inspiration for this talk, I looked at the committee's website and I what they've done recently in the past session, and I picked up one said that I don't know very much about El Salvador, and my eyes quickly fell on the following. The committee notes with satisfaction that the state party has eliminated the death penalty. However, it recommends that the state party should also eliminate it from military offenses stipulated in military legislation during a state of international war. Now, Amnesty International would approve every word here, so the text is fine, but the committee's jurisprudential context is not without problems. Perhaps the committee's approach, or should I say approaches, to the issue of the death penalty encapsulates maybe in extreme form several of the salient problems which may impede its ability to promote its doubtlessly worthy cause in both a principled and effective fashion. I'll look at three everything very briefly. One is the issue of consistency. The other is what I will call occasional lack of attention to detail. And the third is the issue of the committee punching below its weight. Now, consistency is not a straightforward concept when it comes to the jurisprudence of human rights bodies. When we call for consistency, we don't mean a narrow, strict, unchanging approach oblivious to new development. As the committee itself has stated, its understanding and recommendations in respect of effective measures are in a process of continual evolution. On the other hand, we do mean a narrow, strict, and unchanging approach to the fundamental principles at the heart of the treaty, such as, in this case, the absolute prohibition on torture and other treatment. And clearly, consistency means that different states' parties cannot be treated differently on the basis of their shape, form, or power. And this is where the committee has run, in our view, into serious difficulties. In its 41st session in November 2008, the committee examined, among other states, the periodic reports of Kenya and China. Regarding Kenya, which had not executed a single person since 1987, the committee, and I quote, urges the state party to take the necessary steps to establish an official and publicly known moratorium of the death penalty with a view of eventually abolishing the practice. Again, nothing wrong with that. But regarding China, a state which executed at least 1,718 people in 2008, according to our statistics, the committee's recommendation goes, the state party should review its legislation with a view to restricting the imposition of the death penalty. Restricting the imposition. No urging for a moratorium, no eventual abolition of the death penalty. The committee, it should be noted, has on dozens of occasions, I think, either welcomed the abolition of the death penalty by states' parties or called for such abolition, or at least a moratorium. Unfortunately, however, China has not been the first major, this is not an amnesty term, has not been the first major killer state where the committee's knees seem to buckle under. The USA is in an earlier case in point. In May 2006, the committee's general recommendation on the subject was, and I quote, the state party should carefully review its execution methods, in particular lethal injection, in order to prevent severe pain and suffering. Go ahead and execute as long as it doesn't hurt too much. That's it, not even a suggestion that the imposition of the death penalty be restricted, let alone halted or abolished. Which leads us to the second issue, what I've called the occasional lack of attention to detail. What is the jurisprudential meaning of requiring a state that the state prevent severe pain or suffering when killing its citizens in cold blood? Here's what our letter to the committee on this issue said. We wrote on both these occasions to the committee. And note that this was as close as I ever got in to persuading Amnesty to be somewhat sarcastic. And the letter said, the difficulty involved in making fine determinations as to the severity of pain that a person suffers during a procedure which results in his or her death is but one dimension of the problem. More significant still is that the prohibition of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment provided under Article 16 of the Convention vitiates any deliberate use of methods of punishment which cause physical pain or suffering, even if not severe, quote unquote. This constraint is borne out by the Committee's own long-standing opposition to corporal punishment. It seems that not rarely enough, drafters of the concluding observations are unaware not only of the committee's prevailing line on a given issue, but also of the ramifications of what they were writing. Let me give another example from the same issue, also last session. In its concluding observations on the Yemen, the committee, and I quote, also expresses concern at the condition of detention of convicted persons on death row, which may amount to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, in particular owing to the excessive length of time on death row. Now, when I talk to my dad, who's almost 90, and ask how he is, he sometimes says, well, so-so, but it's better than the alternative. So excessive length of time on death row is one type of state failure which death row inmates may not wish to see expeditiously addressed. Another example of not fully thought over statements by the committee is its finding that the use of taser weapons in Portugal, and then they repeat it regarding New Zealand, causes severe pain constituting a form of torture. This is done without explaining under what circumstances this would be so, under what circumstances it wouldn't, and how the other definitional elements, in particular purpose, fit into this finding. My third point is that the committee is punching below its weight. This is one of the key human rights monitoring bodies. Because the vast majority of people throughout the world abhor torture, its statements have international resonance. And yet the committee too often fails to make its voice heard or to make its voice clear on the crucial issues of the day within its remit. Take waterboarding, for instance. The committee said that the state party should rescind any interrogation technique, including methods involving sexual humiliation, waterboarding, short shackling, and using dogs to induce fear that constitutes torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, etc. What happened to the committee's clear, unequivocal findings on Israel in 1997? What happened to the element of accumulation? Why couldn't the committee look, if not at its own jurisprudence, then at the verdicts of U.S. military commissions in the Far East in the wake of World War II, which had absolutely no qualms in convicting for torture Japanese soldiers who had used identical means against U.S. POWs. The committee has also been virtually silent on issues such as what constitutes cruel and inhuman treatment as opposed to torture, where several far-reaching and dangerous interpretations have recently emerged. The committee has issued a pathetic number of general comments, and the first of them is not that great either. But the second one is of a different category, and this has already been mentioned. It was carefully drafted with proper dialogue with human rights NGOs. It is well thought, principled, clear, and innovative. Of particular significance is the discussion of the gender aspect that's already also been mentioned. And in this context, the way the general comment ties states' due diligence obligations in tackling abuse by non-state actors to state officials' responsibility for torture when they consent or acquiesce to it. This is reflected well in some of the committee's subsequent concluding observations, including on El Salvador. We have good reasons to hope that this general comment will herald others, which will equally defend the fundamental principles of the convention without compromise, whilst facilitating greater understanding of its provisions and addressing new and emerging issues that do or should fall within its remit. Let me just end by saying that we're all, of course, on the same side. And it is in this spirit that my remarks were made and I hope are accepted. And I also hope they form part of an honest and mutually beneficial dialogue today. Thank you.
Okay. Even though you say we're all on the same side, I'd now like to take the point of view of a government representative after hearing from the international NGO that has done the most work with the committee. I think it's very important now to get the perspective of a government representative. I'd like to invite Jens Ferkel from the Danish Ministry of Foreign Affairs to give his views on the work of the committee, its strengths and weaknesses, and to respond to some of the challenges which Whitney highlighted in her introduction regarding the consistency, clarity, and authority of the committee, and what from your point of view as a government representative, the committee could be doing better. Jens, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. For this perhaps a little bit dubious introduction, we are on the same side, and I'll show you how. Well, thank you so much for the invitation to present a government perspective on the Committee Against Torture and the efforts at the United Nations to combat torture, including all of other forms of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. Then I don't have to say it again. I'm all the more on it, since it seems that I'm the only government representative on these panels. Perhaps the title is a little misleading. You will not get any official version of the Danish government's view of CAT. You will get some reflections of a person who happens to work for government. There may be a difference, which I will not get into. When I began working on torture as a very young law student, it was at Amnesty International's first campaign against torture back in 1972. Can you hear the wings of history bash? I was under the false impression that it would intellectually be a relatively simple mission. After all, the Universal Declaration says clearly, no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, repeated more or less verbatim in numerous legally binding treaties and conventions. A simple obligation which should be simple to implement. Just don't torture. That's it. How difficult can it be? Well, I recently learned that Kazakhstan, which incidentally holds the presidency of the OSCE this year, has just adopted an action plan to eradicate torture by 2013. So torture isn't something that you just don't do. The main complication springs from the very success of the prohibition against torture. Torture has become more or less unthinkable, or at least impossible to defend, even though I am aware that this defense has been tried. What the consensus against torture has led to is that torture takes place in secret and despite official denial. That is one reason why torture is so difficult to get rid of. One of the most important means to combat torture is obviously the establishment of independent institutions such as the Committee Against Torture, designed but not necessarily fully equipped to combat torture. But there are other relevant institutions. There are parallel institutions dealing with torture, and there are, of course, institutions with wider mandates which include torture. Actually, I'm sure that there are more mechanisms dealing with freedom from torture than with any other human right. Indeed, one of the points I would like to make is the need for these bodies to cooperate closely, for instance, by making use in CAT of the recommendations accepted by states during the Universal Periodic Review and the pledges made by states which candidate for a seat on the Human Rights Council. I realize that CAT is, in fact, aware of this concern, for instance, by regularly inviting the Special Rapporteur and SPT, and of course SPT reports through CAT. Cooperation also needs to be improved in general among treaty bodies. Last November, a number of current and former treaty body members adopted an interesting document, the Dublin Statement on Treaty Body Reform. I believe that Phyllis Geer, Nora Sveos, and Alexander Kovalev from CAT were among them. The statement does not offer a blueprint for reform, but it alerts us to the need to do something. It confirms a desire to cooperate on this issue, and it highlights a number of very pertinent concerns to be considered in such a process. And my government, for one, is fully prepared to carry this process forward. Now, as you know, CAT works in several ways, by examining country reports, by examining individual and, in principle, interstate complaints, by undertaking inquiries into reliable information that torture is being systematically practiced, and by developing the interpretation of the convention by drawing up general comments. Country reports are frequently underestimated as a means of implementation. After all, the possible culprits, the governments who may or may not implement their human rights obligations, decide themselves what to put into the report. Still, this exercise is valuable. The process of writing a country report is often in itself a very helpful process to identify shortcomings. And CAT does guide governments through the process, for instance, by issuing guidelines and lists of issues to be addressed. CAT has developed the process by adopting an optional procedure which, in effect, replaces the traditional report by an extended list of issues, and the periodic report would basically consist of replies to these questions. This system has strong advantages. Technically, it's easier for states to report by answering specific questions rather than commenting on the full convention. And not surprisingly, the committee does not shy away from difficult issues, as I discovered when I just read the list of issues submitted to Denmark. There's no way to avoid possibly embarrassing issues. I also presume this procedure may bring down the delays in the processing of reports in CAT. The model is now also being considered by the Human Rights Council, but regrettably the procedure is rather resource heavy. Most importantly, states are subjected to an examination at the committee. A usually strong government delegation is examined orally over 2 half-day sessions, not in the report as such, but in the implementation of the convention. The committee is well prepared, inter alia by shadow reports from civil society and meetings with NGOs prior to the examination. In this respect, it is important to avoid that the examination becomes, in effect, a dialogue with NGOs through the committee. It is to be a dialogue with the committee. Another possible problem in connection with examining reports is to stick to the issue and not drift into issues more properly dealt with by other treaty bodies. This is not a particular CAT problem. Indeed, it is my impression that it is more prevailing in other treaty bodies. Another irritant, which does not fall under the responsibility of CAT, it's a general UN policy, are the half-day press releases on proceedings during the examinations. They will refer, often in some detail, but not always precisely, to the dialogue at the examination. The problem is that the media and part of civil society get the impression that a question raised by a member represents criticism by the full committee, a kind of verdict. That is not so. The issue may not be reflected in the concluding observations at all. And even the concluding observations adopted by the committee as such are not to be looked upon as judgments, so to speak. I've seen them described by a treaty body chairman as instruments of cooperation, which is a much more constructive approach, although it does presuppose that there is someone to cooperate with. Finally, delayed reporting or lack of reporting represents a weakness in the reporting system, but there are ways and means to deal with it. In particular, the possibility, difficult but possible, to conduct an examination of the implementation of the convention without a report. A possibility which we have seen in other treaty bodies could motivate the state party to draw up some form of a report. And I would suggest that, well, I'm sure CAT has considered to adopt this procedure, but I would suggest that the considerations go on. On the other hand, of course, if all reports came in on time, the committee would drown in its own success. There's already a delay of 1 to 2 years before reports are examined, which, by the way, is not very much if compared to other treaty bodies. When the UN Human Rights Conventions were negotiated, there was much concern about the risk of abuse of interstate communications. That concern has proved unjustified. There has never been an interstate communication in the UN treaty body system. I don't know, perhaps states prefer to go to war over their differences, I don't know. Individual complaints are much more important because they happen. 64 states have now accepted the individual complaints procedure. Not enough, but I find the number respectable, and it's certainly enough to keep CAT busy. I'm not sure the main problem is that of the number of parties to this procedure, as it is the lack of awareness of the availability of this procedure among the population and the reluctance of lawyers to make use of it. I think more could be done in this respect. The committee has adopted a follow-up procedure to ensure that its views on individual complaints are complied with. This is a very useful development which goes beyond the specific wording of the convention. I think you will find that most, presumably all, governments maintain that the views of the committee are not legally binding judgments. The convention says nothing about this, and I realize that it's a contended position, but I prefer to look at this issue in a rather more pragmatic way. We expect others to respect and implement the views of the committee, and so we should ourselves. I can't say much about the inquiry procedure because I don't know much about it. For good reasons, this procedure is basically confidential, and my country has not been subjected to it yet. I believe this procedure is being used increasingly, but still not very often. The committee publishes its interpretation of the convention in general comments. The adoption of general comments may not be treaty-based. It can be debated as far as the Convention Against Torture is concerned, but as far as the other UN human rights conventions, they certainly say nothing about this, but it is a common practice with most treaty bodies. Some do it more extensively than others, and most do it more than CAT. They have adopted two general comments. I presume it's a question of priority and resources, and I'm the last person to criticize the committee for giving higher priority to casework, but these general comments may be very useful. Obviously, general comments adopted by a treaty body carry authority because they indicate how that treaty body will look upon cases or reports brought before it, but they're not legally binding. Their authority is more related to the quality of the contents than their adoption by a treaty body. Resources and the lack of their ability is a major challenge to most of us, and certainly it is to CAT, which is the smallest treaty body with only 10 members. CAT is looking for more meeting time, which would be useful, but very difficult to get through at the General Assembly. And perhaps it might be useful to think out of the box and find alternative resources like the SPT has done. Getting more secretarial assistance would also be very helpful, I am sure. The Human Rights Commissioner is awakening to this issue. But we certainly need even more staff. My country has provided the JPO, a junior professional officer, for the subcommittee for the prevention of torture, and we are in the process of obtaining authorization for another JPO at the torture services in Geneva. But even if more states do so, this is not a sustainable way to support CAT. Governments are also players on the torture scene, and not only as those responsible for torture. Each year, Denmark tables a resolution on torture at the General Assembly and at the Human Rights Council, respectively. Like other UN resolutions, these are results of very difficult negotiations, and that affects their wording, which is far from perfect. In substance, they do, however, take the protection against torture further than the hard law instruments, and in particular, the General Assembly resolutions represent the consensus of the international community. They could be put to better use, perhaps also by the Committee Against Torture. Thank you for your attention and for your patience, and that also goes for Mark.
Thank you, Jens, and thank you for showing and proving to me why you're absolutely right that we are on the same side, but as moderator I do have to be a little bit provocative as well. And also for addressing this important issue which Claudio Grossman mentioned in his introduction regarding the serious problem of resources as another example of where there is possibility to try and find solutions. I'm not sure how much we can go into that today, but that's very encouraging to hear that there are governments, especially the Danish government, who are trying to find ways to resolve that problem, which is not straightforward when you're dealing with a large international institution such as the Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights. And also thanks for some of the other comments, which hopefully we'll get a response from Felice later regarding the work of the committee, and also from Yao regarding some of the specific issues you mentioned about the media, the problem related to the media releases, and also the issue of lack of information about the individual complaints mechanism. So, yeah, I'm not sure whether you could also address that in your response about what might be done to ensure that people know more about this individual complaints mechanisms and possibilities. I'd now like to give the floor to Santiago Cantón, who's the Executive Secretary of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, as I mentioned in the introduction. I think it's very interesting to hear about following on from this idea of cooperation between institutions, etc., the possibilities of sharing of information. In order for the committee to do its work, it needs to be well informed. Where is the information coming from? It's not only Amnesty International, there are other sources as well. We heard from Claudio Grossman that they only have a 5 weeks meeting a year. They have a lot of papers to look through. So the quality of the information which has been provided is very important. And the Inter-American system, of course, is a potential source of that type of information. Santiago, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mark. Let me start first by thanking the Washington College of Law and Amnesty International for organizing this this event. It's always a nice treat to be able to exercise my right of freedom of expression at the university, which is one of the few places someone can exercise it. That right. Let me, as Mark said, I will concentrate my presentation. I'll be very brief, first of all, so we can spend more time in an open dialogue with all of you. But I will concentrate it from the perspective of the regional system, of the Inter-American system for the protection of human rights. In so doing, I will first very briefly explain what are our different activities we do in this field, and then try to think about what are the future cooperation and collaboration that we can all have. For more than 50 years already, the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights has been very active in throughout the region. The issue of torture has been widely followed by the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights since the very beginning of the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights. The first visits organized by the Commission were conducted in the Dominican Republic, and particularly looking into detention centers in the Dominican Republic, and the issue of torture came immediately up. So the very first activity the Inter-American Commission had in its history focused on this issue. And the Commission has dealt with using all the different tools that are at the Commission's disposition. First of all, individual complaints. The Commission receives 1,000 complaints every year on the issue of torture and detention center. The Commission receives probably a couple of hundreds complaints every year from countries all over the Americas. We have now processing probably more than 20 cases regarding this issue, and in the history of the Commission, there have been several cases both at the level of the Inter-American Commission and at the level of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights dealing with this issue. Just to mention some of them that have been laid very important jurisprudence in the Inter-American system: the case of Congo against Ecuador, Bulacio against Argentina, the case of Panchito Lopez against Paraguay, TV against Ecuador, and the Guantanamo case. In addition to individual complaints, the Commission, as I said before, conducts visits. Over the last few years, at least, we have visiting 4 detention centers every year. After the visits, the Commission, in many of these cases, produce a report, and there is always a chapter regarding the visits to the detention centers and the issue of torture. And in a few occasions, the Commission has produced a report specifically about the visit to the detention center. An example of that is a visit the Commission conducted to the Chayapalca prison in Peru, which is one of the highest altitude prisons in the world, and the Commission specifically recommended the government of Peru to close down the detention center and dealt specifically again with the issue of torture. The Commission grants precautionary measures. We have granted several precautionary measures. I mentioned the one on Guantanamo, but we have granted several precautionary measures throughout the Americas regarding the issue of torture in detention centers. And we also have provisional measures. Provisional measures is when the Commission asks the Inter-American Court of Human Rights to grant a protective measure. And again, both in cases in Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, the Commission has requested the provisional measures to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Finally, the Commission has dealt also through hearings. Every year, the Commission, three times a year, the Commission has hearings in most of the time here in Washington. And in every hearing, we receive requests from civil society organizations and in some cases even from the governments to have a hearing on situation in detention centers and the issue of torture. So all of these are the different tools the Commission has used along its history to deal with this issue, sometimes successfully, sometimes not that successful. There are, I believe, very common challenges between the CAT and the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights regarding this issue. One of them is the issue of universality, both at the level of the CAT and at the level of the Inter-American System of Human Rights. Not all member states, in the case of the UN or in the case of the Americas, are part of the pertinent legal instrument. In the case of the Inter-American System, out of the 34 member states, only 17 have ratified the Convention Against Torture. And when it comes to the Inter-American Convention of Human Rights, which is our main instrument, not all the member states also have ratified the convention. The full implementation of the recommendations, again, that's a major challenge in the Inter-American system. It is a challenge as well in the universal system at the CAT level. I mentioned before there have been very successful cases in which governments have complied with the recommendations. But in many instances, governments do not comply with the recommendations of the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights, and the same is true in the case of the CAT. Another challenge that I think we all share is the issue of follow-up mechanisms. If one of the main problems we experience in the Inter-American system is the lack of internal follow-up mechanisms set up by governments in order to follow up with recommendations of the Inter-American system or other universal systems. And that, again, is similar in the case of the CAT. Now, what can we do looking ahead? The Inter-American Commission, I personally have insisted several times over the last few years that if someone looks at the international system for the protection of human rights, both at regional level and at the UN level, someone can see a very uncoordinated and uneven system. It's uneven if you look at how the European system for the protection of human rights is developed, how the Inter-American system for the protection of human rights is developed, the African system, and then you look at the very incipient development is taking place right now in the Asian system, and you see very, very different levels of development in all the systems. Some like the European system, extremely well developed, Inter-American still struggling to achieve the strength that we need to have. The African is in a less developed situation, and the Asian basically is non-existent. And when you look at the universal system in relationship with the regional systems, there's absolutely complete lack of coordination. We start over the last, I would say, 2 years to have a better coordination, but it's still very incipient. It's only with the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights. There are very few instances in which we can share information. And that contributes, in my view, to not a very effective use of the tools there is at every level, both at the regional level, at the international level, for the protection of human rights. We, at the regional level, and the same is true in the African system, we do look at the jurisprudence of the of the UN system, and we use it constantly in our decisions. The same is not true for the universal system, for the UN system. They do not rely on the decision of the regional system. That will helpful, that will contribute for the strengthening of the regional systems. There is absolutely no coordination regarding the visits. Whenever the UN system visits a country in the Inter-American system, there's not necessary a previous coordination or previous share of information among the different systems. I said that we have started over the last few years to try to strengthen that communication. We have a couple of focal points, both at the Commission level and at the universal level in the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights. That has been somewhat helpful regarding the UPR mechanisms. We don't have the same regarding the CAT. That's the possibility we need to explore with the CAT to see if we can have focal points in which we can exchange information. And the same regarding the visits. It will be extremely helpful that both whenever we conduct a visit to a detention facility in the region to get information on the UN side and vice versa. Sometimes the issue of confidentiality obviously is a problem. We had discussed that with the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights. We have not been able to move forward from that. But that's something that needs definitely to be discussed. We need to see a way in which confidentiality can be expanded to the regional mechanism for the protection of human rights so we can share more freely the information. That coordination and communication, I think that can only strengthen the protection of human rights, and hopefully we can start to have a discussion about that. I'm willing and open to answer any question that you all might have. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Santiago. On that point of coordination and communication, maybe Yao, you could also be responding to that. But also, there is a potential for non-governmental organizations to be trying to assist in that, improving that communication coordination. There are ways in which we can facilitate the possibility for the regional and international systems to be working more closely together. To pick up on Jens's phrase of thinking outside the box, I think there is a potential there for ensuring that both regional and global systems work more closely together. Thank you also, Santiago, for describing the way in which the Inter-American Commission works, which is quite different from the committee, this ability to go into the field and to engage with states, parties in the field is quite different to the way in which the committee normally practices its work. And that would be interesting to explore maybe in the discussion about some lessons learned from that and ways in which we may be able to learn from that. Also regarding resources, it could be interesting to come back to the issue of how your commission's work is resourced, etc. We need to move on, though, and I'd now like to give the floor to Florence, who will give us a presentation from the point of view of a national human rights institution, in particular Kenya, which, as Yuval mentioned in his presentation, the Kenyan government did recently submit a report, and there was a dialogue in Geneva. It would be very interesting to hear, Florence, how you felt that process went, and what has come of it since then, and your possible engagement with the committee, especially regarding this issue that's been raised now about the lack of follow-up of implementation of some recommendations and reports. And if you could address that issue, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to thank the organizers for inviting the commission to this forum. And just like to say that the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights is one of the national institutions that was created in compliance with the Paris Principles. And as a result, we have a very wide mandate. We are a statutory body, and we carry out the mandate of investigating human rights violations. But we are also one of the few national human rights institutions that have the possibility of constituting ourselves as a panel and actually offering redress to victims of human rights violations. Now, the Kenya government submitted its first report in 2008, and this is like 9 years after signing on to CAT. During the process which the Kenya National Commission also participated in, because the commission was established in 2003. When the commission was established, the government was very behind on its reporting obligations, with most reports not having been done. And therefore, the commission was very instrumental in empowering government officials on how to make the reports and following up with the government on ensuring that they did the reports. So we were very happy that the government finally was able to do its first country report. Now, obviously, one of the things that concerned us was that Kenya has had a history of oppression, history of torture and violence, and especially perpetrated by the state and state agencies. But because of this culture of impunity, torture and violence is also widespread by non-state actors. And so ultimately it's the citizen that really suffers, and mostly the citizen that is most vulnerable. And so when we looked at the report that the Kenya government gave and the responses that were given by the committee, we were happy that the committee took into account various issues, and especially the fact that it took into account reports by the National Commission and also by NGOs that participated in the process. So if I just were to go through some of the things that the committee specifically said about the Kenya report and the recommendation, some of the concerns that it identified that were very obvious was the fact that it actually identified the linkages between denials of economic, social, and cultural rights to violence, and that was very true in Kenya, because especially violence against women is mostly perpetrated in the private sphere, and this is because of the lack of empowerment of women and also the use of cultural and customary practices that basically are degrading to women and children as well. And the committee also urged Kenya to take all measures so that it could ensure that lack of resources is not an obstacle to access to justice. It also looked at the fact that it was concerned about various reports of arbitrary arrests. And this is historical in Kenya because the police brutality, police used brutality as a means of extracting confessions, for example, from criminals. But also just using it as a tool of intimidation, especially for critics of government. And it also noted with concern the fact that there was violence against women, especially sexual exploitation and trafficking, and that the laws that existed were not very sufficient in terms of ensuring that this did not occur, or that those who perpetrated such violence were actually punished. Now, drawing from these recommendations, first, one of the things that I'd like to say is that in terms of the process itself, as a commission, we found that the committee was generally very accessible, and it was possible to interact with them and to give views, and in particular for the NGOs that participated. They noted that the committee even sat on Sunday, and some of the members gave their own personal time to interact with the NGOs. We also noted that there was a bit of, in terms of giving opportunity. So the commission, for example, was given opportunity in terms of giving feedback and looking at the draft before it was finally made public. And in terms of feedback, We were concerned that there was feedback, but we were also concerned about the things that the committee took into account. During this time of reporting, the committee took into account the post-election violence that had just occurred in Kenya. It also took into account extrajudicial killings that had occurred in some areas in Kenya, such as the Mount Elgon area, and also killings that were occurring with regard to criminal youthful gangs in the urban areas. And because of this, it enriched the committee's report. However, we also noted some shortcomings, and obviously one of the shortcomings that has been dwelt on was just the lack of enforcement mechanisms. The fact that 9 years down the road, there was no way of actually coercing or ensuring that Kenya did a report, even though there were so many reports of violence and torture occurring in Kenya. And then we also noted that there were some structural challenges. And was especially with regard to the likelihood of having different interpretation by different bodies, different UN mechanisms. And also the fact that in terms of seeking clarification, the committee had discretion. And some of the examples, some of the things that the committee, for example, did not take into account in seeking clarification was that the states, they did not make any reference to the state's progress in complying with recommendations by the Special Rapporteur on Torture, who had actually visited Kenya in 1999. It was also clear that there was no proper inclusion of the state's progress of implementation of concluding remarks of other treaty bodies that touch on matters that related to torture, such as because Kenya had also reported on the Convention on Civil and Political Rights. Now, obviously, one of the challenges for the UN system is that there are so many procedures, there are so many mechanisms, and just keeping up with what is going on in different treaty bodies is such a challenge. And yet, for the state, this probably also offers an opportunity to escape with responsibility, because if they know that treaty bodies are not well coordinated, they are not actually working together with regard to specific issues, then it's easier to make responses that are appropriate in one forum that are completely different from another forum. And the other thing is that the time allocation, whereas it was accessible, but time was quite short. And we noted that some of the responses by the government were given without any supporting evidence. So, for example, and therefore leading to misinterpretation, one of the things that occurred was that the committee was asked the minister to respond to the fact that the Chief Justice in Kenya had directed that all constitutional and judicial review applications be submitted in Nairobi, which is the capital city. And this was creating grievous, in my view, violations to citizens who could no longer file these applications as they did before in different cities of the country. And there wasn't sufficient time for this minister to actually substantiate the claims that they were making. And this was an issue that had been raised by the legal fraternity, by NGOs, and by everyone. And the government was not able to actually give a proper explanation of why that occurred. Now, I think that also just looking at the recommendations generally, my own feeling is that the recommendations were, they tried to be specific, but they were not far-reaching enough, because just looking at the history of Kenya, it was quite obvious that Kenya has serious structural problems in terms of legal and judicial processes. And this had been noted even in the NEPAD process when Kenya underwent the African peer review. But the committee's recommendations were not, let me say, probably not radical enough, requiring the government to undertake holistic and drastic judicial and legal reforms, because this is what has led to where Kenya was in terms of torture and impunity. So looking at very specific things like saying you need to reform the bail processes, it's true, it's proper that that recommendation should be made. But really the problem is having a judicial system that is totally unresponsive to citizens, and especially vulnerable citizens. Again, during this process, it was obvious that Kenya had just signed a national accord, a peace accord, that created a coalition government that had committed itself to creating transitional justice mechanisms and also carrying out very far-reaching reforms. And it would have been useful for the committee to have picked on those, so that in terms of follow-up, it would have been very useful to look at what the government was committing itself to, and then how the committee was then going to hold Kenya accountable with regard to some of those issues that they had already committed to. Then I'd also like to say that one of the challenges, I believe, is also just lack of connection between, for example, the UPR process. Kenya is undergoing UPR this year, and it went through the process in 2008. Now, clearly there should be a linkage between the UPR process and all these treaty body reportings that Kenya has done. From where I sit, I'm not sure that the government sees that connection, and it's probably because there's this lack of coordination or lack of pressure on the part of the UN mechanisms to actually ensure that the country sees this UPR process as a process that is holistic, that has built from all the reports that they have made. And then lastly, I think one of the concerns that comes from us as a body that works very closely with victims of torture is the fact that victims of torture and institutions that work around this area are often exposed to reprisals. And the UN mechanism systems do not actually recognize this as a serious risk to bodies and to individuals who report and cooperate with these mechanisms. And so it would be useful, for example, for the committee, the Special Rapporteur on Torture, the Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings, to work very closely with the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders. And in Africa, we even have a Special Rapporteur appointed by the AU. And just looking at these issues from a preventive process, so that before the mechanisms come into place, before a country is visited, what are some of the things that need to be in place so that those who are willing to cooperate are not actually exposed? And what obligation does the country have? What commitments does it make towards ensuring that there are no reprisals against victims and also against institutions that work with this? So I believe that there's a lot of room for improvement on the way that the committee works. Unfortunately, as you can imagine, we've not interacted with the committee for a long time, but what we have seen so far has been very useful. And in terms of follow-up, our institution is actually involved in disseminating the recommendations and getting citizens to actually understand how the process works, and also trying to sensitize them on holding the government accountable to the recommendations, to ensuring that those recommendations are implemented.
Thank you very much, Rojas. And I'm sure that the last comment you made was music to the ears of Felice, who within the CAT has had a responsibility to review follow-up to recommendations. And to hear that a national human rights institution is disseminating the CAT recommendations is a fundamental basic step that needs to be taken more regularly. And so that's very interesting to hear that you're doing that. But also to hear your national perspective on the engagement with the state party prior to the reporting, during the reporting process and following. And it would be interesting to come back in the discussion moment, if we have enough time, regarding that contact that exists between civil society, national human rights institutions and government authorities following the CAT process. I now need to move on quickly to Felice Geer, the UN Committee Against Torture member, for her presentation. Felice, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mark. And I want to thank the Washington College of Law and Dean Grossman for convening this meeting, and Amnesty International as well for its focus on past and present eradication of torture, and to my colleagues for having raised so many interesting questions. I'll try to address two different sets of issues. I came with a prepared set of remarks, but I'm faced with an interesting array of concerns. We were asked to talk about how to build on CAT's successes and address its shortcomings. And those of you who looked at the convention note that what is its goal? If you read the preamble, you'll notice the most clear such statement says that the convention is, quote, desiring to make more effective the struggle against torture, unquote. Now, what is this treaty? Is it a human rights treaty that's aspirational? Is it a crime? Is it a treaty that that will address a specific crime? Is it a treaty that gives you a model of actions that can be taken? The Torture Convention is modeled on the Convention Against Genocide, and it falls in a different category than the more aspirational covenants or other treaties. We now really have the Convention Against Genocide, Convention Against Torture, and the Disappearance Convention now is actually modeled on the Torture Convention in many ways. So we have a series of specific crimes that are to be eradicated. What does the Convention seek to accomplish? In the simplest terms, the Convention seeks to accomplish compliance. It seeks to have states comply with its signature and promises. But it also seeks to prevent and punish torture. Now, in this context, how do you promote compliance? You promote compliance as a member of the committee by getting ratifications of the Convention, getting reports from the committee, because that's what the convention says the governments have to do in terms of the committee as opposed to in terms of their own country and legal situation, by making recommendations to the government, pointing out shortcomings and making specific recommendations. And as of 2003, we've added to this list of what I call the three R's, we've added the issue of follow-up, which I would call the fourth R, which is the reality check. Our colleague from the Danish Foreign Ministry reminds us that there's a fifth R, and that is reform. I would argue that's not part of the treaty per se, but it is every day a major concern. Now, on the issue of ratifications, the Convention Against Torture currently has 146. Joao will correct me if I'm wrong.
No.
Ratifications. 75% of all states' parties have ratified it. That's a very large number, and it's been increasing. And there are 47 states of these that have ratified the optional protocol for the visits. Unfortunately, this 146 still puts the Convention Against Torture in sixth place among the six principal treaties in terms of ratifications. We're well aware of that. Now, scholars have engaged in a debate over the last decade on this whole question of ratification of the convention. They say the convention is not only ineffective in ratifying torture, but it may actually increase it. It may be giving a free pass to governments. The studies of Hathaway, Vreeland, Goodliff, and others claim that the CAT gives cover to bad countries who can just sign the convention and then walk away and pocket the fact that they have somehow done a good thing, when at home, of course, they don't do it. In fact, they have an easier time of increasing torture because they've signed it. I would suggest that the argument that ratification comes at no cost, that more dictators who torture sign that than those that don't, and that the convention allows governments to have symbolic cover, is a flawed interpretation, and it doesn't really take into account what the conventions can do. And aside from the dubious data, which I won't go into, it doesn't get into the issue of the fact that the convention is not just about signing, and it's not just about adopting a law to criminalize. It's about the need to, first of all, carry out a variety of activities in the convention, to investigate, to educate, to provide redress or reparation to victims. Importantly, the convention has worked to raise awareness and understanding of the variety and forms of torture and its prevalence today, and to build a political and a cultural basis for compliance with the convention. One need look no further than the important work of the not only of the committee, but of the international criminal tribunals on the issue of rape as torture, to understand that a gender perspective on the issue of torture, which wasn't there in 1984 when the convention was adopted, is there now, and this convention and this committee played an important role in raising that awareness, in empowering victims, in mobilizing support for society to create the institutions, whether it's National Human Rights Commissions, regional commissions, or other NGOs, or legal measures in the society itself to work to combat and eradicate torture. Now, that's the issue of ratification and what does it accomplish. On the issue of reporting, I would say that the we get lots of reports. We have a backlog. We cover 7 countries in each session, 14 a year, which is more than most of the other committees, and certainly more per day of meeting time than any other committee, except arguably the Race Discrimination Committee, and other larger committees which have 2 chambers and are able to cover more. But per person, per meeting time, per report, the Convention Against Torture is overwhelmed with getting through these reports. And if something like general comments don't get the attention, I think the word pathetically small number was used in one of the earlier comments. I did write it down. I would say it has as much to do with the lack of meeting time and the lack of those kinds of resources as anything else imaginable. Now, reports from governments have been complained about since the treaty system began. And we're being told by governments, time and time again, every imaginable explanation and complaint that they can think of for why they can't get reports to us and why they need extra attention and loving care and time and assistance and technical assistance to help get these reports done and in time. Well, folks, that argument has gone out the window with the introduction of the Universal Periodic Review Procedure. Universal Periodic Review Procedure has now reviewed more than 90 countries, 80, 90, somewhere it's up in, it's close to half now. And every country has submitted a report. And none of them have been late. There's only one possible late country, that's Haiti, which has asked for a formal delay in connection with the recent events in terms of the earthquake. 90 countries didn't have problems coming in with a report on all of their human rights commitments to the political bodies of the United Nations. So any more complaints and excuses about governments not being able to produce reports, something's wrong with that procedure. Something's wrong with that argument. And the committee, however, has been very flexible on this issue, and we have revised our procedures to try to overcome the fact of states complaining about not being able to submit reports to us. And what we've done is we've not only adopted a list of issues, we have now adopted, and you'll hear more about this from Mr. Nataf, a list of issues prior to reporting as a way of changing the size, the style, the format, the response mechanism, and the ability of states to come in and do that. Third issue, recommendations that we make, and we make them on country reports, we do them in connection with inquiries and with regard to petitions. And time, and this has been going on since 93 for the state reports and earlier for the other two procedures. Now, states come in and tell us that the views adopted by the committee are not binding, whether it's the views on a country report or on an inquiry or on a petition. And it is the job of the committee, with the help of everybody on this panel and in this room, to change that reality. Why are the reports, why are the views not binding? Why is this procedure so weak in that case? And we need to be in a position where we don't come by and say, oh, by the way, we're really so thrilled to discover that certain number of countries have adopted a law criminalizing torture or something like that. We need to be in a position where the committee's views are considered as not just authoritative but binding. Now, the Inter-American Commission has a court that it can appeal to and turn things to that makes that a stronger kind of process. The treaty body system has nothing of that sort. And one has to ask seriously whether the proliferation of different bodies dilutes the decisions and views of the committee, or whether it strengthens it. Whether having totally independent mechanisms combines to have a greater effect or a weaker effect, and whether something else might be necessary in that context. I'll come to that at the end of my remarks, which I think are probably very soon. But look at the successes with regard to recommendations. Universal jurisdiction. 109 countries have incorporated universal jurisdiction into domestic legislation. 14 countries have actually tried cases based on it. This is clear, a positive result. Torture is criminalized in domestic law. Rape is recognized as torture, and why it is torture, and that it, as torture, it is absolutely forbidden. Non-refoulement procedures exist in country after country, and they comport with, in many cases, the CAT. In other cases, we're still working on it and will be. Investigations take place on issues of reparation. You'll hear this afternoon. But I only want to point out that even in an area like that, the committee has been able to see results in particular cases and beyond. Now, there's been some mention of the follow-up procedures and issues of effectiveness. I've just got the one-minute sign, so I'm not going to tell you about follow-up other than to tell you that. There have been reports to the committee. There are summary records on that. There will be further reports on the follow-up procedure, but we have used it for 87 country reviews involving 82 countries. And in that context, We have been 76% of the time the committee has called on countries from all world regions to conduct prompt, impartial, and effective investigations. 61% prosecute and sanction the act of torture. And in 57% of the case, we've complained to the countries that they simply lack legal safeguards, like providing access to a doctor, a lawyer, a relative, or anything like that. Coming in sixth or seventh place have been recommendations regarding gender-based violence for follow-up. This is a work in progress, and lots has to be accomplished there. On the comments of my colleagues today, Amnesty, Whitney in her initial remarks referred to consistency three times, and so and we heard that on this panel as well. I won't use the traditional quotation about consistency and being a hobgoblin or anything of that sort, but more to the point, the question is, on what issues are we going to talk about consistency? We've heard about the issue with regard to the death penalty. We haven't heard about it in regard to everything else that the committee is doing. There is a disagreement on the committee over whether the death penalty falls under the convention, and that's well known to everyone. So in addressing issues with regard to consistency of conclusions, one might want to look more broadly in that regard. On the question of the convention not being legally binding, I've made some comments. Media releases, I'm sure Joao will speak to that issue as well. On the question of the Inter-American Commission and tools that are available, I'd like to recall that, again, in trying to think of how we could make the convention more, to strengthen the convention, you know that there's the proposal that Manfred Novak has made about a world court for human rights. One might want to think about the question of whether there needs to be some kind of an appellate procedure or some kind of an appellate body to which would have binding authority. Novak says countries should come in and hand over all petition procedures to the world court. That's his proposal on human rights. The Inter-American mechanism might be a better model than his model, and I would suggest having a look at that. On the question of the tools that are available, there was a lot of discussion of the Universal Periodic Review and the relationship to the committee. Again, I'd like to say the resources devoted to the Universal Periodic Review by the Office of the High Commissioner and the states' parties together are like a dream for anybody who's worked on treaty bodies. The number of people, the time, the resources, webcasting, all of these things could be utilized to strengthen the treaty body process without getting to a court or anything of that sort. We have really had a splendid presentation of how a National Human Rights Commission can be concerned with NGO with the committee's concerns. And I wanted to offer one small corrective. My understanding is that the Kenya National Commission did not have access to the concluding comments. Concluding comments are a confidential matter, and while there have been some incidents where some members of the committee have been known to go to governments and present conclusions, sometimes in the same building, members no longer on the committee. While there have been such cases, I'm not aware of any case ever where a NGO has been given concluding comments in advance, and I would hope that there would not be such a case. My understanding was that what the Kenya Commission saw were the replies by the state, by the government, to the questions, these are part of the public record, the replies of governments. Those are not the confidential comments. Finally, on the issue of follow-up, if I may, there was a meeting of there's something now called the intercommittee meeting, which consists of representatives of each of the treaty bodies to talk about reform and treaty procedures. At the meeting in December, it was decided that follow-up, that a new committee, a new subcommittee on follow-up would be created to help to consolidate and prioritize the recommendations of the treaty bodies so they, in fact, feed into the UPR process, the technical assistance programs of the High Commissioner, the work of special rapporteurs and others, going the other way from the treaty bodies to the more active on-the-ground mechanisms of the UN. Whether that will actually come about in practice is anybody's guess, but with your interest and support, it might happen. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Felice. I deliberately gave you a few more minutes. As a member of the committee, you have the right to have a little bit more to say, and it's even unfair to ask you to speak so quickly on all the issues that have been raised. But thanks for touching on those matters. I'd now like to finish with giving the floor to Yao Nataf, the Secretary of the UN Committee Against Torture. Yao, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mark. First of all, I would like to thank the Washington College of Law, Amnesty International, and the Chairman, Claudio Grossman, for this initiative. I think it's particularly important that it happens now in 2010, and you will understand why after I finish, I hope so, my presentation. I want also to say that being the last one to speak has got a lot of pros and cons. The pros is that what you wanted to say have already been said, and the cons is what you wanted to say has already been said. So I don't really know. I hope that you will beg, I beg your indulgence for having a completely, listening to a completely destructurized presentation. I would start with the issue of, trying to analyze on the four main tasks that have been mandated to the committee, which is considering reports, considering individual communications, undertaking confidential inquiries, and adopting general comments, to try to see what is the situation now and how each of those tasks could be improved in the future by the committee with the assistance of the Secretariat. I would start with individual communication. Thus far, the committee has registered around 400 individual communications concerning 29 states parties. It has considered closely about 300 of them and decided on merit on 150 and found the violations of the convention in approximately 50 of these individual communications. However, and that's the assessment of the situation. However, the situation nowadays is that close to 100 individual complaints are pending before the committee. And this has been criticized, and I think it's correct, by state parties and by right holders that this backlog is too important. A number of state parties have expressed concern also that interim measures of protection have been requested in a too large number. And especially in the case of Article 3, which is a non-refoulement obligation of state parties, and that the committee takes a lot of time to decide on the merit of those cases. And this is a problem for state parties, but also for right holders, because the decision is not taken in a rather expeditious way. With regards to confidential inquiries, and to reply to your questions, all states parties except eight of them have not opted out to this procedure, and the committee has undertaken seven of those inquiries until now, and is at each session allocate some time to discuss this issue, which is a very important issue, but the members of the committee have to look very seriously into this issue. With regard to general comments and also to reply to your question, the convention is one of the few that actually has specifically mentioned in the text of the convention the possibility to adopt general comments. So it is a mandated task by the convention to the committee to adopt such general comments. However, as it was been said previously, in the past 22 years, the committee had only adopted two general comments. And between the first and the second, over 11 years actually elapsed. And this is definitely a problem. I would not refer to General Comment 1 because I think it's completely outdated and actually is very detrimental to the committee's action, because it even states that the committee is not even a quasi-judicial instance, which I think nowadays everybody agrees that treaty bodies are, but the committee on this one has mentioned that it is not. So I think it's important that the committee looks into amending or dealing with this issue with regard to General Comment 1. With regard to General Comment 2, I think a lot of things have been said, so I will not come back to it. However, I would like to draw a parallel with regard to other treaty bodies that have adopted general comments. And I will just take one other treaty body, CEDAW, that has approximately the same number of sessions of the Committee Against Torture. The Committee Against Torture is going to held its 44th session, and CEDAW held its 45th session. And CEDAW has adopted 26 general comments. So you can see discrepancy between what CEDAW has done and what CAT has done. I don't want to anticipate what I will be saying later on, but I think there are reasons why this is the case. Also, it is important to mention that all this doctrinal approach, the study of the convention, has been done by other entities, especially by the Special Rapporteur on Torture, who has actually adopted reports on a huge variety of issues that are relevant for the convention and for the committee, from anti-terrorist measures to corporal punishment, from gender-specific forms of torture to universal jurisdiction or solitary confinement. I mean, the Special Rapporteur has actually done some of the work that should have been done by CAT, because CAT is the guardian of the convention and the sole guardian of the convention. In addition, other mandates, not only the Special Rapporteur on Torture, but other mandates also have looked into issues that are relevant for torture. The Working Group on Disappearances, the Special Rapporteur on Summary Executions, the Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Slavery, Special Rapporteur on Trafficking in Persons. I mean, all other special procedures of the Council have also looked into issues that are the competence, the mandate of the committee. Now let's move to, and I'm sorry again for this being a bit hectic, to the how the committee implements actually, for the countries that have not ratified, the convention, the impact that the committee has is rather limited. The committee cannot do much about that. However, for the states that have ratified the convention, the committee has several tools. One of them, and I will divide this in two parts. First of all, for the states that have never reported to the convention, the committee has regularly sent reminders. It has empowered the Secretariat to try to brief states party on the importance to report. And actually, the number of states that have never reported have been reduced from 2007 to 2010, from 41 to 33. So I think there is some action, proactive action from the committee on that side. With regard to the states that actually report, and also to answer your questions, that the committee could actually schedule the consideration of a country without a report. The country has threatened to do that twice in the past, and actually it was successful because the committee gave a deadline for the submission of report. If a report could not be presented within that deadline, the committee would actually consider the situation in the country in the absence of a report. And in quite quickly, those two states came and presented a report, which shows a little bit what this guy was saying before, that if states party wants, they are able to produce a report, or for the UPR, or for treaty bodies, when treaty bodies actually put them against the wall. The other engagement with state party or the follow-up procedure, but I think Fizgar already spoke about that. And I will just try to develop quickly, because I think it's an important new innovative procedure, is the so-called list of issues prior to reporting. But just before that, I just want to mention the interaction that the committee has with state parties and NGOs, civil society in general, NGOs and NIs. At each year, the committee runs a meeting with state parties. It will be, again, in this May session, where all state parties are invited to have a dialogue in general with the committee. And at each session, the committee sets aside 1 hour per report to consider information from NGOs and from NIs. So definitely, I think CAT has been on the forefront on this interaction with state parties, but also with NGOs and national institutions. With regard to this new innovative procedure, which is the adoption and remittal of list of issues to the state parties prior to them submitting a report to the committee, the committee is pioneering on this, and as also it was said before, other treaty bodies are looking into this, this possibility, and I think we are looking at the future of treaty reporting. One thing that has to be clear is that this is an optional reporting procedure, because the reporting procedure has been established under Article 19 of the Convention, and the Committee cannot amend the Convention, obviously. So it's an optional procedure that states, if they want, can avail themselves of this procedure. If they don't, they will just report under the normal reporting procedure. What are the benefits? What are the added values of this new reporting procedure? Well, the first one definitely is that a report submitted under this procedure will be much more focused than a normal full-fledged report, because state party will be replying to specific issues that were asked, that were tailored by the committee to this state. Second, it will allow state parties to submit their report in a timely manner, because the committee established a deadline for the submission of those answers that will be the state party's report. Thirdly, it will definitely facilitate the elaboration of the report, because it is much more easier for state parties, especially for state parties that don't have important financial and human capacity to prepare a full-fledged report, to reply to specific issues. So this will really facilitate the elaboration and presentation of reports. The fourth advantage of this procedure will be that there will not be any subsequent list of issues. After those list of issues are submitted, which are the report, the committee will examine this report in a period of time maximum of 1.5 years after this. So no other procedural moment is needed between the submission of the report and the consideration of this report. And finally, it will really shorten the period while the reports are pending, I think for the benefit of all, because as soon as, if not a long period of time will elapse from the submission of the report and the consideration of the report, the better the dialogue will be. So I think those are the five main advantages of this procedure. However, from the Secretariat point of view, I think that the committee has decided not to apply this procedure to initial reports, which personally I think I think it should apply also to initial reports, because it's better to have, the committee says that this is the case because for an initial report we need to have a full-fledged report. We need to have a report on everything. Yes, but better have such a good report, but have information on the state party anyway. And secondly, if a state party really follows the guideline, even under this list of issues prior to reporting, the report should be as complete as a full-fledged report. So I think that the committee maybe should revise this idea of keeping initial reports out of this procedure. As I only have one more minute, I will just want to mention in a summary that the committee has one of the largest mandates of all treaty bodies. It has the smallest membership. And in addition to all this, it has decided to go for innovative procedure in order to assist states parties to fulfill their obligation. Can anyone ask more for the committee to do? This is important. This is important at this moment for three reasons. First of all, because there will be a new special rapporteur will be appointed this year. So I think this will bring again the light on the special procedure. The subcommittee on the prevention of torture will move from 10 to 25 members, and that will highlight its visibility. It will undertake much more visits, and again that could be put the light on the subcommittee. And finally, most probably this year, the Convention on Enforced Disappearances will enter into force, creating a new treaty body that will have mandates that are, in certain aspects, similar to the ones of CAT. So what is the solution for the committee? Well, there are three solutions. One is that the committee reduces activities, interpreting to a minimum its mandate, and I think this would be very negative. The second one is to increase the membership of the committee, and I think this will be difficult because that will imply amending the convention, and that will take at least a decade or two. And the third one will be to increase the meeting time of the committee. And that's exactly what the committee sought. The committee has several times already requested the General Assembly to increase its meeting time. The chairman has at the last 64th General Assembly in his address made that plea to have more time for the committee. However, the General Assembly has decided not to give that to the committee. What is interesting is that just 1 year ago in 2008, exactly the same plea from another treaty body, which a similar backlog of report and a lesser backlog on individual communication, was given an additional week per session. And that was the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. So I think the committee has done its share, but now it's the time for the international community to also do its part to allow the committee to perform as it should perform. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Yao. Unfortunately, we've gone over time. However hard I've tried to keep people to 10 minutes, but as you saw yourselves, it was not possible to cut some of our panelists off in mid-flow, if I could put it that way. Compared to the next panel, but we have to be fair to the next panel, we do have six panelists and they only have four, I think, so I've taken the liberty to go over time, so Claudio, hopefully you will not deny me the right to have lunch or a cup of coffee later on. Ten minutes maximum. Okay, all right. So I did want to have questions from the floor in order to have some dialogue going with the panelists. That's one of the advantages of having such a collection of people in terms of audience and panelists. So I'd now like to open the floor, and I'd have two hands up here. If I could take all the questions first, I think that's in terms of time, it's smarter to do it that way. If you can keep your questions to 2 minutes, please. Anybody else? Just the two questions? Three, four, and Gopal over here. Five. All right, that's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. I think that was also one of the issues that had come up, that the committee doesn't have to be doing everything. When we heard so many different presentations, that there maybe it's a time to reflect on redefining its role and new divisions of labour between the different partners and potential partners for the committee. So thanks for making that point. And sorry, could you introduce yourself? Could you make your point, please?
I think what is the best question in the case for those who have been victims of human rights abuses to be empowered by the day for themselves, and they can be especially important for promoting human rights. And I think organizations like is not really enough to do that. This is something that needs to be addressed. And I think perhaps what needs to be created is a watchdog organization for the watchdog organization to create mechanisms of accountability so that these organizations can become more effective. And because of the bloated bureaucracy undermining their effectiveness,
thank you. Maybe the next panel can also take up this issue of the giving a voice to victims of torture in when they're looking at reparation. Sorry?
I wouldn't talk to you.
Okay. Okay. Can we move to the next question, please? We had back at the back. Yeah, here we are.
I would like to focus my question on the five R's you have mentioned, but I would focus on the reality check and the reporting of regrets. In many countries, especially third-world countries, there's a lot of human rights abuses going on, provincial level, or city level, or even town level. And these things, most of these abuses, don't find a way national level of reporting, say like Commission on Human Rights, whatever. And so the report of the Commission on Human Rights, the United Nations, or the Amnesty International, is very sanitized. But if you go to the media, the local TV and the radio and media outlets and the databases, they have, say, in a 5-year period, they have 500 human rights abuses of different categories and different levels, different kinds of people. The Commission on Human Rights only reports, say, 10 or 20. So it appears that the country is very sort of compliant and peaceful, and the reporting system is really sort of railroaded. So when it comes to the case of Latin America or Asia or even Africa, in this case, it appears that in the UN they're very compliant. So my question is, how sure are we that the reporting system passed on to the UN is really that the real issue, the reality check is really correct, as what we think it is. So do we have some thoughts from people from Latin America or Africa? Thank you.
Thank you. We had one more question here, and then Gopal on the left. No? Gopal, if we could take your question. I think this works. That's all I can take. I'd now like to invite the panelists to respond to those questions and other issues that may have been raised by other panelists in our concluding remarks. Felice, would you like to start?
I was looking for something that I wanted to reference.
Jens?
Somebody has to go first. Well, I would like to start out with one issue that Florence raised, namely that of the relationship between the Universal Periodic Review. I keep calling it the Universal Peer Review. I think that's a much better name, but that's not its name, which is a surprisingly useful new instrument because it is being taken very serious by practically all governments, which is a reflection that of what Felice also said, namely governments have time to do reports for the UPR but not necessarily for CAF. Well, if it's a zero-sum issue how much time they have, I'm not sure that that's a bad choice, but I hope I haven't forfeited my lunch on that one. But the treaty body recommendations are indeed taken very seriously under the UPR review. My country, for one, goes systematically through the relevant recommendations, and a great work has been done by the UN Secretariat because they compile reports where we can find quick references to them, and to see which recommendations, we don't take all of them, but which recommendations are serious enough or for other reasons do we wish to take up during that review. So that is being done. And I'm sure that most treaty bodies also, on the reverse, take up the recommendations that have been accepted at the Universal Period. The periodic review. So I do believe that this is actually being done. I will not comment on the suggestion for CAT to reduce its activity. I mean, you can always rationalize better, I suppose, but Yes, I'd like you to get into that more than I can do here. I'm not going to reply to all questions, but I'll take up two more. The definition of torture, yes, it is. Actually, it's very difficult to comprehend, particularly with the adoption of the Convention Against Torture, which splits up torture and cruel inhuman and degrading treatment without defining CIDT. So there is a problem there, but try studying the reports of Manfred Novak, and you'll get wiser on it. Finally, secret detentions are really the subject of attention. Four special procedures have written a very heavy joint report on precisely that issue, which we are supporting that they submit to the Human Rights Council, which is in session now. Thank you.
Thank you, Jens.
Just on question number one about reducing the activities of the committee, I do not share this view at all, because I think that the mandate of the committee has to see as a whole. I mean, if there are four different tasks, the mandate is a whole, is at the state level with the reporting, at the individual level with the individual complaint, for dramatic issues dealing with systematic practice of torture in a certain country, the inquiry, and finally the doctrinal, the interpretation of the convention with general comments. So if you reduce one or the other, the committee will not be fulfilling its mandate as it should. So I would really not be in favor of the committee reducing its activity, especially because this activity has been mandated by the state parties themselves, who voluntarily have created a body to do that. So if there is a creation of a body and that body itself interprets its powers in a reduced way, I think it really should be very detrimental for human rights.
Okay. I'm not sure whether her comment was reducing the mandate more, but
reducing the activity. Yeah. So.
Okay. but we haven't got enough time to get that. Yuval, you have the floor for your final conclusions and your also responses to issues that have been brought up by other persons.
Okay. I share my colleague's opposition to the idea of reducing, and it does have to do with the mandate. If you have to amend the convention to add members, you certainly have to change the convention to reduce the number or the provisions which the CAT should ensure are implemented and monitor them, etc. The need for victims to be empowered, nobody disagrees with that, except those who victimize them, of course. Part of the reasons why people are become victims is because they are disempowered, although I don't like the question of have any of you been tortured, therefore the whole idea of being human is being able to sympathize and empathize with other people and talk to them and be able to work on their behalf even if you yourself have not undergone the experience. But of course victims should be re-empowered or empowered, and we're doing our best. Do we have to do more? Of course. And I would be grateful for more concrete criticism, of course. The idea of people beating outside of prisons, that not being torture, is wrong. The criteria would be, and it's also in the ICC Institute, that the person is under the control of the other person. So shooting, etc., would not constitute torture. But if a policeman is in control of a demonstrator and beats them up severely, that would be torture and should be torture. And I disagree with Novak on that. So the definition is not that bad, I think. Secret detentions, again, an expert was once asked, a criminologist, is there a perfect crime? And he said, we don't know, do we? I mean, the whole idea of secret detentions is that they're hidden. And obviously, as you're saying, we do need special expertise for that. But I think we did not do a bad job regarding the black sites of the U.S. Around Europe. Thank you.
Thank you. I can just move in that order then. Felice.
Thank you very much. Well, let me start with Christine's question. Of course we can limit our activities and focus our work on only a couple of issues. And then we'll have a seminar a year from now in which I saw Steve Groshaw, I was going to say, not only Amnesty but Human Rights Watch would come and have a session on why the committee isn't doing enough. We have considered it enormously important to be sure that in addressing torture, we're addressing everything that falls within that. At the same time, we're aware of our working methods, and working methods can sometimes produce peculiar results. Steve's just coming back in now that I talked about him. For example, on the follow-up mechanism, we have found that in the 87 countries reviewed, we have asked, we identified for follow-up 1 to 5 topics for all but 35 countries. And we've started to identify 6 or more topics only since we changed our working methods to have a new form of conclusions. And now we go 6 or more conclusions and follow-up items because we've changed our working methods. Of course, we have to put these two things together, how to be efficacious and how to be more precise with our working methods. Why is codification an example that I gave? First of all, I was arguing with the data, the kinds of data that are used in the articles by Hathaway and Vreeland and others. Secondly, because codification is not insignificant if the rest of the legal system also works. And the point that was made about Kenya's judicial system not being responsive to the rest of society is one that we grapple with on a daily basis. But if you look at our general comment number 2, paragraph 11, in which we talk about the importance of codification of the definition of torture. It will emphasize the need for appropriate punishment that takes into account the gravity of the offense, strengthen the deterrent effect of the prohibition, enhance the ability of responsible officials to track the specific crime of torture, and enable and empower the public to monitor and, when required, to challenge state action as well as state inaction that violates the convention. Codification is a good indicator if we're going to get into the discussion of efficacy and compliance theory and whether states uphold such conventions, whether they do more harm than good. On the issue of empowering the watchdogs and the NGOs, I challenge anyone to look at the procedure of the CAT with regard to NGOs and their involvement and conclude that this is somehow not at the forefront of what the UN has been doing. We not only have, long before other committees, called on NGOs to submit material in advance and made it a part of the process, but now with the web and the procedure that we have, and I'll just to summarize it, those submissions that come into us are posted on the web and made available worldwide. I this was the model, I think, for the UPR, frankly. And I think that this is enormously empowering. On the specific question about the 5 R's and that local abuses don't get to the national level reports, that's what our whole review is about, is to challenge the reporting that comes from states parties. No report comes from a state party and floats through unchallenged in any way. And then finally, on this question of the definition of torture and its applicability more broadly, the question Gopal asked, I think everything we do focuses on the fact that this definition with its 4 purposes and its many components is a very broad one, not a narrow one, indeed. And in our general comment, again, you might look at paragraph 18, which makes it clear that the failure of the state to exercise due diligence to intervene, to commit acts impermissible under the convention, that the state's indifference or inaction provides a form of encouragement or de facto permission, and that the state has applied this principle of state parties' failure to prevent and protect victims to, from gender-based violence as a key approach. So we have, we're clearly looking broadly at this definition and what is acquiescence, what is consent, what is the responsibility of the state there, and we try to do that at every session.
Thank you, Feliz. Santiago, okay. Florence, last comment.
Okay, I'd just like to comment on the issue of whether how the information gets from the national level. And for us as a commission, our experience has been that we are actually able to make very bold reports. If you look at our website, our commission was able, for example, to document the violence and list the names of alleged perpetrators on the post-election violence. We shared that information with the inquiry, government-instituted inquiry, and we are sharing that information with the ICC. So as a commission, we are very confident that we have reports that do not gloss over anything, and they are going reaching up to that level. We've also made reports on the violence in, that were perpetrated by gangs and the government agencies, and these reports are very graphic. We actually have lost one of our informers because of this, and that's why I was emphasizing the fact of reprisals, because sometimes you need insiders to give you that information, and those insiders actually then are at serious risk. And our experience has been that some of those insiders have actually been targeted, some of them have been killed. And this is because of the explicit reports that they give us, and we capture and we transmit them to special procedures, to the national bodies, and also to the UN system. So I believe that if you have strong national institutions, whether they are human rights institutions or NGOs, that are able to capture what is going on at the national level, it should be captured at the international level. How the UN does it, I suppose they have their own procedures about, you know, how they engage with governments. Maybe they are more politically correct than some institutions like ourselves, but we do give that information.
Thank you very much, Florence. I have to stop there. We have gone way over time. I did want to provide you with some conclusions of my own. I think this will have to come up in the final session of the afternoon. In this panel, we've been able to expose a lot of the relevant issues. I can't go over them now because there is a lack of time. But I'd like to thank all six panelists for their presentations and also for the conference participants for your questions as well. Thank you, and we'll move now to the next panel.